Something has been added. Well, I have an announcement that has to be made this morning. I am told by an authority on the subject that the book sale is over with the beginning of this lecture, and that the remainders will be taken down into the front office for those who wish to examine them later. We have to clear it upstairs because of the auction sale. They want to put some chairs up there so you can sit down for that. And there will be a number of interesting books on that sale, which we hope you'll be interested in. For instance, Babbage Light and Color in the original edition is a very rare book. There are a number of rare books by Waite, Raphael, and some works on palmistry, long out of print, by Cairo, and scarce editions by a number of different authors whose writings are seldom, if ever, found. This auction will be held around 1:30 in the afternoon upstairs, and you're all invited to attend. The interest in this is very important to us because it constitutes a source of revenue by which we can repair library books that are in need of rebinding and also advance our publishing funds, which are not too abundant at the moment. This morning we have an interesting subject which I think has rather important practical implications here and now. We all know that a great change occurred in Europe at the time of the Protestant Reformation. At that time, the authority of the Roman Church to control the minds and destinies of most of Europe was broken forever. This power ceased, but nothing took its place. After the passing of a little time, Lutheranism took over as much as it could, but it was an entirely different type of belief. It was unable to meet the challenge of complete control of the religious life of the European people. Very soon, other Protestant reformers began to appear, and a conflict of beliefs resulted. And this conflict has come down to us as a priceless heritage. Also, very much in this period was the great period of war. Europe was in war most of the time in the early years of the Protestant Reformation. The 30 Years' War was a terrible experience for all concerned, and as might be expected, it was largely involved in religion. This problem brought many people to the realization that there was great need for some basic change in religious outlook. The collapse of the power of the Roman Church also had a strong effect upon secular matters. It began to undermine strongly this change, brought about a minor and later major change in the theory of governments. The divine right of kings gradually faded away, and the church and the secular governments both lost their totalitarian authority over the lives and thoughts of people. In this particular period of things, there arose in Europe a compensating factor. It suddenly became obvious to a great many persons that where leadership was removed, the individual had to stand on his own feet. It was as though Europe had come of age, that it could no longer depend upon a complete parental umbrella controlling, directing, and enfolding the people. It became necessary to begin a new way of life in which faith became increasingly personal. This is also clearly set forth in the great utopias that appeared in the 16th and 17th centuries. These utopias were imaginary worlds of religious, philosophical, and educational integrities. The utopias were worlds in which principles, truths, and ideals were to have sovereignty. The first of the utopias, of course, came from More and was possible because of the freeing of England from the power of the church, which was finally lost through the destruction of the Spanish Armada. In any event, the utopians were a people of good hope, and almost all the utopias had to do with the improvement of society. All of them, however, with the possible exception of Bacon's New Atlantis, all of these utopian dreams were very conservative, rather stuffy, and quite orthodox. They were well-intended, they were a great advancement over previous conditions, but they were also little tyrannies of themselves. Those who lived in these utopians atmospheres did not have freedom. They had only the right of total obedience. They had to do exactly as they were told, or else simply be cast out of the organizations. They were not allowed freedom of thought. They were only allowed to be free from a previous despotism and to fall into a smaller one which they had manufactured for themselves. This, of course, led largely to the concept of colonization in the Western Hemisphere, and most of the colonists, except the Spaniards, were utopians. They were people looking to build a new commonwealth in the Western Hemisphere. They came over here for freedom of belief, but in a very short time began to impose restrictions on that freedom, so that in the end, a tremendous pressure of orthodoxy dominated nearly everything. So the great dream of a utopia was gradually lost, and the people were forced to come back to another pattern of life. It is as though a child became an adult, and with this adult condition was expected to take care of his own internal resources. This the average person was unable to do. The result was a gradual emergence of countless creeds, arising from private and personal convictions about truth, about religion, about God, and about the purpose for human destiny. All of these groups were more or less alike in most matters, but the dissimilarities were sufficient to separate them into very often conflicting groups. All of this leads down to the rise of mysticism in Germany and later in England, and particularly in Germany with the works of Jacob Behme, and in England with the works of William Law. These mystics were, in no sense of the word, ordinary visionaries. They were not mediums, they were not psychics, but they were convinced that it was possible for the human being to have a direct internal experience of truth. Behme went so far as to qualify this by the concept that he could find within himself that truth which was natural or proper to himself. Therefore, there might be different interpretations of truth, but if they came from within the person, they were largely suitable to his own personal needs. Well, this went on for a time, but then other factors began to intrude themselves. And finally, we find the rise of the new dispensation of dominant beliefs. We no longer had the power of the absolute divine right of kings, but we had political instruments that were becoming more powerful every day, and in many instances were just as tyrannical as the monarchies which they sought to overthrow. We also lost the control of a great moral and ethical concept of life as found in religion through the rise of science. And in science we find gradually human dependencies turned more and more upon external pressures and circumstances. The individual trusted his life to the doctor instead of God. And the doctor himself, however, might be in prayer at the moment. But that was the way it worked out in common practice. Little by little, man became more and more convinced that his destiny was hopelessly involved in the material environment in which he found himself. His new ambitions were not necessarily for self-improvement, but for creature comforts. He was not so much concerned with being right as he was concerned with being rich. And, of course, these various personal ambitions, made into groupings, formed the basis of one war after another. Little by little, the policies which the human being tried to build to maintain himself in a world in which there was no longer any spiritual or moral authority, the effort to do this has led to utter confusion and very largely to the problems that we face today. We know that Bacon named his New Atlantis after the description found in the Critias of Plato concerning the submergence of the Atlantean islands. Bacon doesn't say anything about the possibility of another world catastrophe of this kind. But in sober thinking, we begin to wonder if earthquakes and volcanoes destroyed the islands that disobeyed God. We are now a little bit alarmed and concerned over the rise of nuclear fission, which could produce a still greater catastrophe than that which is recorded by Solon. We are in the presence of a great and immediate danger. And what have we to face it with? Most people are very much frightened. The whole way of life has become so centered on material comforts, material concepts, material environments, and the fulfillment of personal material and ambitions that it seems impossible for the human being to survive the destruction of his own mistakes or to continue to exist without the comforts that he has declared to be essential to his survival. So today we are in the midst of another problem very much like that of the 17th century Adventists. The problem of what is next and how are we going to face it. Every day we pick up the newspapers and we find further cases of delinquency, further evidences of cruelty, and a continuing pageantry of selfishness and self-centered ambitions. It is obvious, I think, to most people, even the selfish ones themselves, that this procedure is impossible. The only possible end of it will be disaster. Now, in this phase, we are much like the 17th century people. They felt that the loss of their religious life and so forth was a great disaster. But they were determined to create a reformation that was to make this progress rather than destruction. We realize that they accomplished something. They did open the way for a complete revolution of knowledge and opened the way to most of the advancements in science and arts, literature, music, and so forth that we know today. But on the other hand, we are not exactly of a mind to make some kind of a major religious or spiritual step in the advancement of our problems. This is one of the things we face today. What is the only hope of the individual in the present situation? Surrounded by the dangers of delinquent children, surrounded by rape and carnage, surrounded by international complications that seem unsolvable, in the present of continual uncertainty concerning employment and survival, with rising tides of individualism expressing through constant strikes and the creation and organizations of groups to defend or destroy certain causes. The answer is, what is the private citizen to do? He is in the presence of what might be called a tremendous personal emergency. An emergency of learning to understand the reason for the conditions as they are. And what is he going to do about it? Those who feel that the answer to the whole thing is annihilation are not certainly thinking very straight. They are thinking very largely in terms of a dismal melancholy, a frustration, a negative psychology. They are becoming gradually, like hundreds of millions of people today, near borderline psychotics, pushed into this situation and into this dilemma by insecurity which they cannot face and do not understand. Well, to meet this, there's been a revival, again, of mysticism. And mysticism is something we've had with us always. It was in the church. It was before the church. It was in Alexandria, in Athens, in Greece, in Egypt. Mysticism was always an experience of personal integrities. In mysticism, the individual develops an internal realization that he is a significant being, that he cannot be simply pushed aside or decimated by circumstances. He has inalienable rights. And the most important of his rights is that he has the right to be right. He has the privilege to live well regardless of the environment in which he finds himself. To transcend a material environment, each person must find a depth within himself. We spend a lot of time saying what is wrong with the environment, but we do not realize that it is our adjustment to the environment which is essentially destroying us. We are unable to survive the pressures of things outside of ourselves, and yet we have within ourselves principles that are indestructible. But we do not realize this and do not know how to use the tremendous internal potential that has been given to us by an all-wise providence. Actually, no individual is destructible unless he destroys himself. In some mysterious way, he must be the cause of his own failure. He must be the reason why he is a narcotics addict. This was not destined. This was not something that was predestined and foreordained. It was a weakness of himself, a lack of internal strength and integrities. And these, in turn, in all fields of violence with which we are now suffering, alcoholism and gasoline do not mingle. All these things and the crime waves, the accident waves, the adulterations of food, the exorbitant exploitation of the commonwealth, these things all rest with people. They are not something that rose out of an infinite demand for obedience or decimation. They were problems which we created ourselves. And we really recreated these problems because we were not strong enough to keep the principles that we believe. Actually, by recent testing and so on, and recent surveys that have been made, 4/5 of the Earth's population has religious affiliations. And the other 1/5, having little or no religion, is also comparatively indifferent. Also, occasionally, it presents the same kind of problem that religion itself presented in the times of the Holy Inquisition. Actually, however, the available resource of spiritual conviction is enormous. And the only reason why it is comparatively impotent in these times is because we don't use it. We are not able to capitalize on our own internal capacities for faith, strength, and courage. We have become so addicted to problems that the great tragedy is loss of material things. The infinite disaster is economic failure. While these are the attitudes, we are going to sacrifice principles for profit, and we are going to sacrifice our own inner life for the maintenance of things that are comparatively secondary. So the modern thinker is drifting back, at least in spirit, to what might have been termed mysticism. It was not the so-called false or shallow mysticism that was decried by Nicholas Murray Butler. It is a mysticism based upon a study of what is inside of the person, a realization that every physicist must ultimately face, namely that the human body itself is an unsolved mystery. We can take care of just about every part of the body except that which dwells within it. And as long as that which is the dweller in the body is sick, the body itself cannot remain a healthy and normal cooperating structure. We have to find out about the person in the body, the power behind the body, how strong it is, how thorough it can function, and how it can come to assist us in the present dilemma. Plotinus, of course, who was one of the greatest of the Neoplatonic mystics, was convinced that the power within the body was the savior not only of the body, but the savior of the mind and the savior of the world. There is a power of salvation in every living thing that, if it is applied, becomes part of an infinite potential for survival for all living things. In other words, if we could find the link and serve the inner life as well as we have served the outer compromises that have come to be considered normal, we would find a very great difference in the world affairs which we now face with so much fear and anxiety. So the mystics have a certain point on this subject, which is not a metaphysical point primarily. It transcends that. It is more like a mysterious science of the soul. It is something that has nothing to do with the common visionary experiences of psychics. It has to do with certain deep processes within ourselves. Plotinus describes the great journey of life as the journey of that which is lonely to final union with that which is forever alone. There is some way in which the individual going inside of himself finds allness, whereas if he continues forever going out from within into the world around him, he does not find allness, he finds ultimately nothingness. The mystics in the early modern times had many very interesting and constructive points of view. They all agreed that the final liberation of the individual from ignorance was self-discipline and self-attainment, that there was no possible way in which material education could save the individual only if that individual uses education to release the inner life within himself. Education is to help him to be more rather than simply to increase his earning power. Enlightenment is not something that makes him master over other men. It makes him master over himself. Everything that has to do with the improvement of self is important to the common good. But the things which constitute improvement of self do not conflict in any way with the advancement of the collective. It is not the creation of the egotistic, self-centered self that wishes to dominate all others, but the self that, having no interest in dominating others, has found union with self. Having found union with self, honesty is possible. Honesty also has to do now with the courage necessary to achieve this union. And as in the case of the colonies that came over here, most of those that came to this country in the beginning, except the Spaniards, were utopians. They all came here searching for a new world in which they could live their principles. They came here for the holy experiment, as William Penn called it, the experience of creating a cooperative commonwealth, and to place at the head of that commonwealth an omniscient power. They were to serve God through the establishment of a way of life in which godliness was possible to the average person. It was the overcoming of selfishness and the overcoming of ambitions that dominated the theories behind men like William Penn. Yet when they came over here, within a short time they were in trouble. In a very short time they began to exile their own members for differences of opinion. Little by little, economic processes took over, land was fought for, all kinds of misdeeds were committed against the native aborigines. Everything that had been part of the real principle gradually faded away to leave the powerful, destructive, industrial, economic complex which has gotten us into the present difficulty. Now, we know from the religions and beliefs of countless nations that faith is a tremendous thing. Now, what is faith? Faith is the cure for fear. Faith is that which makes it possible for the individual to remain dedicated through character and integrity with truths which he does not fully understand. He may not understand the universe, but as far as his own faith can go, he can treat that universe with respect, intelligence, and kindness. He may not know the end for himself, but faith gives him a realization that he was not created by an accidental power. He was not here for no reason. And the reasons for his being here are still under dispute, because all knowledge today avoids these questions, considering them unanswerable or creating some kind of an arbitrary, insufficient solution to the eternal problem. Faith, therefore, begins with a quiet acceptance of the fact that there is a reason why we are here. There is also a reason why we are in trouble. And the reason why we are in trouble is because we are living in variance with the laws of nature and the laws of God. Now, many today do not like to think of the powers of God. God becomes a symbol of an autocrat. We have God more or less involved in the concepts that dominated the Middle Ages. But actually, we have to assume that somewhere there is something behind what is happening. There is some reason why the individual making certain mistakes always suffers. And there is also some reason why, when he corrects his mistakes, he suffers less. There is some kind of a law and order in everything. And every science has discovered the fact of law and order, but not always able to explain the workings of these facts or to define them completely. In daily life, therefore, we have people today who are in all kinds of disasters and distresses. We get phone calls every day from persons who are unable to carry their problems with dignity. They do not believe that they should be suffering. Well, we have to agree that probably they shouldn't be suffering, but they are suffering because of something they shouldn't be doing. And this goes on and on and on. Many people, for instance, have decided in their own minds that membership constitutes a solution to moral problems. It does not. You can belong to anything or nothing and be in the same trouble if you continue to make the mistakes that have gotten you into the trouble in the first place. There is no escape from difficulties by adding your name to a roster or presenting a church with a stained glass window. This is not an act of piety. It is bribery. And all types of bribery are unpleasant in the sight of divinity. We are not supposed to try to buy our way into a better state of life. This was one of the points that annoyed Martin Luther and resulted in his final separation from the church. We are not here to buy our way to heaven. We are not here to buy indulgences. We are not here to show our religion by attendance to anything. We are here to have the opportunity to grow. As one of the Rosicrucian mystics in the 17th century pointed out, we are all abecedarian students in the school of the Holy Spirit. In other words, we're in various grades, mostly apparently in the lower grades, of the hope of redemption. We are probably somewhere in the second or third grade, and we are all in the same little red schoolhouse together, and in this schoolhouse there are the grades all the way from a kindergarten to a high school graduation, and all carried by the burdened life of one teacher. Now, this more or less represents the general state of things as it is. The great universities do not change the facts very much, as Comenius so wisely pointed out. He pointed out very definitely that the only solution to the world's problem was personal honesty. And personal honesty is very hard to develop. Another thing Comenius was perfectly certain of was that we must depend upon the children of this generation to run the world in the next generation. And unless they are taught properly now, they will preserve the delinquencies of the present day into the infinite future. Then Comenius said, you must start with the very basic principles of life and education. The most important of all educational factors is integrity. And every child should be taught to be honest before he is even taught to read and write. I think I mentioned before that I went over a curriculum that is in use in Japan in the school system of how the studies are arranged. And the curriculum for the grade school which more or less corresponds to the German concept of the gymnasium. The curriculum for the grade school was integrity, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Integrity first. Honor before spelling. Honor before adding and subtracting. And the use of adding and subtracting to maintain honor. And you go to the college, it was the same. Before the geometry and the calculus came integrity. All the way through the educational system. Now, this integrity principle is very hard to teach a person who has seen his own parents in trouble all their lives, who is a product of divorce or desertion, or whose education is limited to a school system in which all references to religion are regarded as unrealistic. The Comenius, who was the father of the present public school system, made it very definite that the beginning of a good life was to believe in realities, to honor that which is honorable, to obey the laws of the inner life as well as the codes of national conduct, and to know that forever throughout life we are living part of and involved in a tremendous integrity. If we violate that, we are lost. And the only way we can find out that we are lost is through natural punishment, which is in the form of suffering. Therefore, the beginning of our understanding is that we shall, without proof of a scientific nature, but a proof proven by tens of thousands of years of human experience, that the individual has the right to live well, that he has the right to keep the truths, even others if others break them, that he has the right to be honest regardless of temptation, and he has the right to be an intelligent creature unless he violates or sacrifices that right to maintain some stupid pattern of his own. So that out of this comes the old belief of Comenius, that the child should learn to know and to understand that he is living in a great divine university in which by experience he learns all things, and that this experience is not only his teacher but is also the instructor of every other living thing, for all creatures that inhabit the earth survive by experience and also survive by keeping rules which they intuitively or instinctively obey, whereas man who has a better mind is given largely to breaking them. So we have the great need for a recognition of faith, a faith against defeatism, a faith against the gradual collapse of our personal lives, the breaking of our homes, our disappointments in children, rising crime, mutilation of property. All of these things exist. And they exist because something is wrong. And that something that is wrong is a higher intellectualism on one side, which has denied the integrities that we most need, and an extravagant economic materialism on the other that tells us that the most important thing is to be rich. Lord Bulwer Lytton, in one of his stories, tells us the story of the young man whose father taught him that there was nothing important in life but money. He should get it, no matter how, but he should get it. And as a result of long indoctrination in this concept, the young man killed his father to inherit his fortune a little sooner. And this is very largely what we're doing. This is our problem. And the only way we have to get out of it is to believe there's something better. And the moment we believe something better, we are believing by means of faith. It is faith that reveals to us the possibilities of all good. And this faith is sustained by the experiences of 100 different cultures and civilizations that all have passed through the same experiences and have all failed from the same causes. And there is no reason to assume that we will not fail also if we do the same things that they have done. make the mistakes they made, and forever compromise principle and truth for profit. Now, war is one of our great enemies, and nuclear physics is another. These are now combined together. Even assuming that we never do have a nuclear war, the race for nuclear armament is going to finally leave us with a planet so polluted by waste material from atomic research, nuclear research, that we can't live on it. All of these things go on and on and on, and are this a strange evidence to absolute mediocrity of thinking. They are really little better than the attitudes of a person psychologically disturbed. And we consider this disturbance by a variety of names, but the answer is that we are sick. We are sick because of the fact that we have lost a vision of constructive purpose. We have lost the dream of being something that would be a pride to pass on to the future. We are not only no longer planning to pass something worthwhile along to the future, but at the moment we are afraid that we have destroyed the future along with ourselves. Now, this type of thinking is fear. And fear is destroying our morality. It is undermining our education. It is making it apparently desirable to have all the fun you can for today because tomorrow you'll be dead. This was the old Roman concept and is the reason why they put a skeleton at the banquet table. It was to remind that only one end comes to all, the dance of death, the endless procession that ends in the grave. Now, all of this doubtful, negative thinking is gradually taking over. And we do not know what to do about it. We would like to have better leaders, but leaders have to be chosen from the ranks of followers. And while the followers are as they are, the leaders will be no better. We would like to have someone come along and solve the whole thing and sign a great treaty by which we would end forever all nuclear competition. The question is, how are we going to find anyone to sign that treaty? How are we going to find anyone so much better than we are that they will keep rules that we would break to personal advantage at any moment? So we come right back to the problem of building an inner life to take care of whatever happens on the outside. We are part of something that is larger than we are. The belief that man survives amidst the phenomenon of death has been universal. And this universal sense of survival, this something that must go on, whether you wish to assume that this going on is through progeny or through the perpetuation of the internal self in our own natures, the problem is something must go on. And something that goes on must be better than what we have now, or it won't go on. So each person has to make his own adjustment. For this problem, when it comes to the end of life, each one of us must face our own conduct. We must meet the ends which we have come to deserve. And after we go into the earth, we will no longer be able to blame anybody for anything. We have the need to build a decent life now. And build a good life now. Some years ago, I was present at the deathbed of a very nice young man. He was happily married. He had two lovely children. He was well-to-do. And he was a trained scientist. He was an educated man, a university man, frightened to death. Death was not the worry, primarily, probably. It was the fear of death. He did not want to die. He felt it was a great injustice. And yet, sarcoma had taken him. And I was with him just a few hours, in fact, a few minutes before his death. I saw that strange gray pale go over him when death came. And you couldn't but wonder to yourself what this was all about. that this individual went out of this world frightened to death, went out of this world feeling that it was entirely impossible that this could have happened to him, when he had proof beyond evident that he was a successful man. I remember the last day before he'd passed, he looked at me and he said, "I wonder, is there something beyond this? Is it true that there may be a life beyond this?" He couldn't be sure in himself, but he began to wonder. Now, today, most people are wondering if there are any times beyond the ones we're in. Are there going to be days in which good things can happen? Are there going to be times when our children and our children's children will grow up in a decent world? The answer very largely rests with us. It rests with the ability of the individual to become a servant of realities rather than to a servant of profit and loss. If we can achieve the integrity of the inner life, we will have a great reward. And the little book, The Practice of the Presence of God, by Brother Lawrence, is something to mention in this case. Peace arising from faith in the divine purpose. Faith in an invisible good at the root of existence. Faith that what we're going through is part of a purposed existence. And that we are like children who do not want to go to school and are perfectly willing to cheat in the examinations if we can get away with it. But that actually, as the Greek success assumed, this world we live in is a threshold of eternity. And Socrates, a few moments before his death, told them around that were gathered around, he said, "This is a situation which I must face. Either when I finish this life in the next few minutes, I will go into a world that is larger than any I have ever known. And here I will meet and know all the truths which I have sought to understand. Here I will have no further doubt about immortality or the reality of divine powers. I will go forth to the solution of my noblest convictions and dreams, or I will go to eternal sleep. But in either case, I will be more fortunate than those men who have falsely accused and convicted me, and must keep on for some years themselves to live with the conscience evils that they have caused." This is more or less the problem as we face mysticism and as we face faith.